Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's home edition, recorded on this date, December 7th, 2020. Well, while the Trump administration's hard line on Cuba undid the diplomatic and economic advances of the Obama years, there's hope in the long-besieged Caribbean island nation. The inauguration of the 44th president's vice president, Joe Biden, will signal a return to political rapprochement and removal of trade restrictions imposed by the departing Republicans. But it's no sure thing. Though the president-elect promised to return to Obama-era policies while campaigning, specifics are uncertain, and media and Senate pressures are already being applied. Randy Caravaggio is a social justice defender and organizer with Victoria Goods for Cuba and coordinator with Victoria's contribution to the Pastors for Peace Caravan to Cuba. He's also been a constant champion of the revolution in Venezuela and Bolivia and longtime supporter of Palestinian sovereignty. Welcome back to the program, Randy.
Thanks for inviting me, and it's good to be on the air with you again.
Well, it's always a pleasure, of course. Now, Randy, before we get to Cuba, Venezuela held elections Sunday. Now, how did the polls go off?
Well, there was a lower turnout than usual, so it was a 30% turnout. They were trying to elect 277 deputies that will renew the Venezuelan National Assembly from this year to 2026. There were lots of machines deployed nationwide, about 30,000 of them, so people could easily go and vote and everything. There were 14,400 candidates registered from 107 national and regional political organizations. So it was pretty spectacular. Everything went very, very smooth. No violence, no attacks, no nothing. So that was all good. And the renewal to this National Assembly, the ruling government got the most seats from it, some 68%, actually. It was expected, since the opposition made all kinds of bad moves in the past. The extreme right used all kinds of destructions and sabotage and tried to get coups against the governments and lots of violence. So in the last 5 years, the Venezuelan National Assembly, instead of acting as, you know, do good for the country, really their biggest energy was to how to oust the president. So and then they were in contempt. So the judges basically stated that all any laws that they would pass were void because they were in contempt of the law. So it was very destructive for Venezuela. So I think that with this election, it's going to pull the country together and hopefully work things out so that the Venezuelan citizens can have a better life. That's really what it boils down to.
Well, and for us up here now, this wasn't the presidential election. This was an election for the House. And it's pretty complicated because there's more than one national House. There's vying houses of representatives. And I'm looking at an article from the Miami Herald. They say, well, now there's three Congresses within the country, two different houses vying for each other.
Well, I mean, you know, with the Venezuelan National Assembly having, you know, been doing what they have been doing, the government had to do something about reestablishing some kind of, you know, order and government so that they could govern the country. I mean, especially when Venezuela has been attacked very, very heavily from countries like Canada, the United States, and Europe. All the colonialist basically countries, there were all kinds of situations where they've been trying to destroy the economy, and they've done a great job. So, you know, you've got sanctions and you can't buy stuff that you need for the country. And on top of all that, you know, there was the National Assembly going along with all of this, with the opposition and all that. So you know, the government had to form a different group, and it was a very democratic group, constitutional assembly, so, or the People's Assembly, I should say. So with these situations, you know, governments have to move to make the country run smooth and give as much as they can to their citizens, you know. So the opposition had tried everything to get rid of the government, except using the electoral system, which they, you know, automatically refuse. We're talking about the extreme right. They refuse to go along with these elections. So and you know, there were international observers from 17 countries, representatives from Argentina, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Colombia, Ecuador, France, Guatemala, Iran, Ireland, Paraguay, Romania, Spain. I mean, you name it, they were all there. There were former presidents from Ecuador, Rafael Correa, the Bolivian president, former Bolivian president, Evo Morales, the former Uruguayan president, Jose Mujica, the former Spanish president, Jose Rodrigo Zapatero. I mean, then there were, you know, the multilateral bodies, including CARICOM, the African Union, the Council of Latin American Electoral Experts. So they were all there. You know, the ones that were not there, as I stated before, it was Canada, you know, in regards to the government, the United States, and the European Union. So if the opposition was so sure that they had the support of the Venezuelan people, why would they refuse to run in these elections? You know, and all of these observers stated that it was fair, it was clean, and it was as democratic as it can get. So I think this shows that the right wing knows that they cannot win democratically, so they resort to all kinds of various undemocratic ways to try to get the power. And obviously they've convinced the government of Canada, the government of the United States, and European Union to support these extremists. So, you know, it's a situation. But I think if people wants to see the truth, then they have to look at these facts and figures. And I think that we need, as people and looking for the truth, we need to tell our governments, such as the Canadian or the European Union and the United States, that sanctions are just to starve people. They're not going to, I mean, the Venezuelan citizens have been there now for the last 20 years under these conditions, although under Maduro, it's been even much, much worse than when Chavez was there, with sanctions. And people are suffering. The Venezuelan government stated that there's about 40,000 people in Venezuela who have died because of these sanctions. So, and we're not, you know, we're talking about medicine, we're talking about food, we're talking about oil, we're talking about all kinds of human necessities that these sanctions affect. So it's monstrous activities that these folks are doing. You know, I think that the Maduro government has done extremely well with the conditions that they've been put in. And how they've been governing the country.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, the Canadian government doesn't recognize the legitimacy of this this latest poll. They didn't recognize its legitimacy before it went off. Similarly, they didn't recognize the presidential elections that returned Nicolas Maduro even before the elections went off there, and mostly because the opposition, what they typify as the main opposition fronted by Juan Guaido, although his support doesn't even justify that, but he did manage to hold the presidency of the National Assembly, which a lot of those members boycotted this latest poll as well. And it's on this so-called illegitimacy that Canada and the Lima Group and the Organization of American States say that the Maduro government is not legitimate. and so therefore sanctions are justified.
Well, you know, to be able to recognize Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela is as undemocratic as you can get. There were no citizens in Venezuela that voted for that man. It was their own clique of people within the National Assembly that basically supported, and it's a very small group of people that supported him. And then he goes out and says, "I'm president," and countries like Canada with the Lima Group recognizes him. I mean, it is the most ridiculous thing that Canada could get itself involved in, but it has, and as I stated, I mean, if you look at what happened in the last 20 years in Venezuela, and if you look before that, you'll see that there's been changes. There's been major, major changes. So the power structure has switched somewhat from, the real rich class into the working folks. There's been like something like 10 million homes produced and given to people who needed them. There's been factories who have been turned into co-ops. The oil industry, I mean, most of the money that was coming from the oil industry, which was a major, major big resource for Venezuela, it wasn't staying in Venezuela. It was coming right down or up to the United States. When Hugo Chavez came in, he nationalized it. And what did he do with the money that he was getting from the oil industry? He produced missions. Missions of all kinds of housing and for women rights and for workers rights and for indigenous people. I mean, it's been incredible what this country has been able to construct. But there's an opposition that lost their power. And that opposition is very well wealthy. And most of them are no longer even in Venezuela. I mean, when there was a lockout from the management so that people couldn't go to work, they were trying to oust Chavez, President Chavez, 2002. Basically, the people went back to work and put the whole oil industry in place again at work. And what had happened was that after that, 16,000 of those saboteurs who were locking people out, the folks that basically owned and operated the oil industry, they were fired. They were fired, and the management was created by the working folks. Now, where did those 16,000 people go? Well, a lot of them ended up in Alberta, and they had money. And so that's why I think Canada is going along with this thing about, we've got to get rid of Maduro, we got to get rid of Chavismo, and reinstate people like Guaido. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing. But the fact is that the opposition is well organized and they have a lot of wealth, and so they go to the European Union, they come to Canada, they go to the United States, and they talk to these governments and state all kinds of lies in regards to human rights abuses and torture in the prisons and killing in the streets, which is totally a bunch of lies, because no such thing like that happens in Venezuela. And especially the government, it doesn't want anything to do with that. I mean, and then at the same time, they close eyes in regards to what's happening, for instance, in Brazil or in Colombia. I mean, in Colombia, pretty much every day, a social activist gets murdered. If you are a union organizer, the worst place to be is in Colombia. You're for sure going to get killed if you're the president of some unions. I mean, there's massacres almost every day. And yet, what does Colombia receive? Well, they don't receive sanctions. They receive millions of dollars in support of that kind of government. Brazil, I mean, we don't. If people want to really find out the truth, they're going to have to look at these things. So I think that the extreme right wing, because we, by the way, I mean, we have to state here again, is that 90% of all the politicians have participated in this election. It's just a small group of extreme right-wingers that have not participated. And these are the folks that have been recognized by Canada and the Lima Group and the states and the EU. That's what's going on. So,
well, if I was going to be cynical, I would say also regarding the oil industry, the type of oil, the nature of the oil produced in Venezuela is very similar to what's produced in Alberta's tar sands, very
exactly.
heavy. And so Venezuela is a competitor, and Canada has been hit hard by the downturn in the oil industry, not as much as Venezuela has, but hard nonetheless. And if I was cynical, I might say that Canada was just hoping to sow chaos at the heart of one of its main competitors' economic system for its own benefit. But that's, you know, I can't prove that, of course. But Chrystia Freeland, our current finance minister, was the main actor behind the Lima Group formed specifically to undermine the Venezuelan government.
Yeah, there's no question about it that Canada took, a leadership position in the Lima Group. You know, so obviously, I mean, for Canada, you know, it's not just the oil in Venezuela that's at stake. There's gold, there's silver, there's all kinds of goods that these Canadians and European and American companies would love to get, which they pretty much had before, but they don't have it now. That's the difference. This is the same thing as Bolivia. I mean, why was Evo Morales ousted? I mean, it was the best economic situation of any country in Latin America, and yet the OAS with Canada, with the United States, they claimed that, you know, he had to go, so there was a coup, and now all of a sudden, after a year, when they turn the country around and it's in total disruptions of a decent society, and all those benefits that Evo Morales brought, they were wiped out within a year, and then they go to the election, and what happens? And basically, we are told once again that they were supporting dictatorial rules, and it was total undemocratic what they did there. And I think that's the same idea they want to do in Nicaragua. That's the same idea they want to do in Cuba, and that's the same thing as they want to do in Venezuela. I mean, these are colonialist, neocolonialist countries that basically believe that they can go backwards instead of forward and reestablish, you know, what was going around 60, 70, 80 years ago, that they can go to these poorer countries and take the resources, get the cheap wages, and then bring it back home. And I think the Venezuelans, the government and the people, because let's face it, you know, like the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years, they've gone through hell and back. And yet now we see another election, and the people supported the Chavismo movement. So this is telling us that the Venezuelan people are saying, look, it's not going to happen. You guys are not going to come to our country and just dictate on what we can and cannot do and who we're going to have for government. You know, that's what it boils down to.
Well, but even so, you mentioned that the official participation estimation was somewhere in the 30% of registered voters showing up for these for this poll. I read in the opposition, well, I'll call it the opposition paper, the Miami Herald, they claim it's lower, in the low 20 percentile. Either way, it seems quite low to me. I thought Venezuela was famous for its political participation. Do you have any idea, Randy, why the numbers are so low?
Well, I mean, they've gone through many, 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 countless, I mean, election in the last 20 years. And, you know, people are somewhat tired. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, I mean, you go and vote, and the thing gets worse. And so people sometimes don't know what to do. But, you know, the thing is that the Miami Herald or any right-wing newspaper can say whatever they want, but the fact of the matter was that yesterday there was also an election in Romania, and it was exactly the same turnout. Oh, yeah. But what does Romania get? Well, they don't get hang out to dry in the sun, but Venezuela does. You know, and with all these observers that were there, they said it was as democratic can get. You know, I mean, there's different issues, you know, why people don't turn out. And I don't know all the details of that. I can't really say. But the fact is that, you know, they're trying their best to survive, because that's, you know, when you have sanctions, it's no fun at all. I mean, the and especially now with this COVID thing, which again, Venezuela has responded very well because they have a great healthcare system. That's why they have been able to respond. But at the same time, you know, there's these sanctions that really, really makes people suffer. That's what the situation is.
Well, it's really telling too that in Venezuela there's Cuban doctors and medical teams, the same teams that were available next door in Bolivia, but that the coup government there immediately tossed out of the country, and much to their own dismay, as it turned out, as the COVID ravaged Bolivia in ways that it didn't in Venezuela.
Talking about, you know, COVID, if you look at any countries that has a good healthcare system, they had way, way less deaths than places where they didn't have a good healthcare system. And I would like to say that the progressive governments of Latin America, and I would say Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, if you look at those three countries, they have done the best in regards to COVID. Now, you can even go outside of the area. You can go to Vietnam, for instance, which they have 90 million, almost 100 million people. Now, this is like, let's say it's a third of the population of the United States. Now, in the United States, I forget the numbers, but what is it, 150,000 deaths or something?
Closer to a quarter of a million, the estimate I've seen.
All right. In Vietnam, it's close to 100. 100 only died in Vietnam. Now, you know, if you look at that, you say, okay, there's something wrong with this picture. There's something really, really wrong with this picture. China, you know, we're blaming China for almost anything that happens under the sun at this point. But the fact of the matter is that in China, about 4,000 people died. Now, people say, oh, well, you know, it's dictatorial, and they put these conditions that you can't do this and you can't do that. Well, the fact of the matter is that in the States, as you said, it's almost a quarter of a million people died. If you look at Brazil, if you look at India, I mean, it's not, and now I'm going into developing countries, but if you look at Europe, if you look at England, if you look at Italy, if you look at Germany, I mean, they have bad news. So obviously, there's something wrong with this picture. Now, let's look a little bit in Canada. In Canada, we have about, I think it's around 4,000 people that died, if I'm not mistaken. I know I've had friends of mine lately in the last year, since COVID started to happen, that basically you go to the emergency room and you wait there for 6, 7, 8, 9 hours before you get seen. There are people who have died in Canada because they cannot get surgery. So, you know, above the death of the pandemic, we also have an issue on the other deaths that are happening because the healthcare system is not doing well. You know?
And how many people are we going to find out about down the road who couldn't get into cancer screening and so forth and all these things? But, you know, when you're comparing these countries and the different systems with their efficacy in responding to the pandemic, I would say that you don't even have to go that far afield, Randy. You could just look at this country and the provincial governments, because of course, health is a provincial mandate in this country, and the governments that would be considered more progressive in one province than another. If you compare that along the continuum of outcomes, you find that places like British Columbia have a much better outcome than neighboring Alberta. Ontario and Alberta definitely stand out as being having the worst outcomes.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what it boils down to, is that when you have a progressive government that cares more about people, and you get better education, you get better health care, you know, you got better jobs, I mean, it's going to work better. But, you know, when you have extreme capitalist societies, you know, I mean, basically people get left behind. You know, and we've seen this, like you mentioned before, in Bolivia. I mean, you know, if people were dying in the streets and they didn't know what to do with them. So, you know, people had to invent, like, you know, how to burn these bodies And so they had these burning chambers on wheels. This is what happened. I mean, in Bolivia, you know, it's the most disgusting thing that I was able to hear, you know, during the last year, is that our government doesn't have resources. They do have resources. We all have resources for our citizens. It's just on how we put those resources to use. And if we give most of the resources to very few people and the majority don't have these resources, well, you're going to have these conditions where, you know, under COVID, people are going to die.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Randy Caravaggio. Randy's a social justice defender and organizer with Victoria Goods for Cuba and coordinator with and contributor for the Pastors for Peace caravan to Cuba, amongst other things. Randy, we're fast out of time for this segment. Randy and I are going to continue this conversation, and you can hear it in its entirety at guerrilla-radio. Well, Randy, that's all the time we have for this segment, but I want to thank you for coming on again. I want to thank, too, Diana Johnstone and Janine Bancroft and all the good folks that keep the wheel spinning up here week in and week out. As I said, Randy and I will continue. There's great programming coming up, you know that, but that's all I've got for this week until the next time. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. This is the home edition. I'm talking today with Randy Caravaggio, and Randy is a social justice defender, an organizer with the Victoria Goods for Cuba campaign, and coordinator with Victoria's contribution to the Pastors for Peace caravan. Randy, that Pastors for Peace caravan, I guess with the COVID and everything, a big crimp has been put into that. Are you still involved with them? Is it still something that's happening?
Oh, yeah. No, the caravans are still happening year after year. Our organization in Victoria has been involved in different projects. We participated in 21 caravans. So wow. It was since 1992 until, I think, the year 2000.
Well, maybe we should describe what it is for people who don't know. I mean, as you say, you've been doing it for a long time. But what exactly is the caravan to Cuba?
Well, Pastors for Peace was originated from the States. Lucius Walker, a Baptist minister, basically started it. And it was all on the idea that they disagreed with their government stance on Cuba, with the blockade and all this harassment and threats. And so at that time, there was the special period where the Eastern Bloc countries collapsed and Cuba lost about 75% of their economy, and the U.S. blockade was being tightened, and people were really suffering. So the Pastors for Peace caravan started, where basically the way it works, there's basically groups from all over the country that organizes to raise funds and collect aid and get vehicles and from all over the country and even from Canada, and sometimes also participation from Africa and Asia and Europe. So, and then they all start the caravans in different places. We were actually most times we were the first one to start the caravan because we were the furthest away from Cuba. So we would organize events. We would get this aid all packaged and everything onto vehicles. And we would go from one city to another, to another, to another. And there would be presentation and all kinds of stuff. And more activists and more caravanistas would join the caravan. And these caravans would converge either in Laredo, Texas, or in different parts before it got going into Mexico. And then from Mexico, it would go into the Tampico port, and all the stuff would be loaded in these containers. And then all the caravanistas would fly to Cuba for 2 weeks. And then about a week later, the containers would arrive and they would distribute the aid throughout Cuba.
Well, and it was an exciting thing to follow from this side too, you know, because the Americans at the border, we weren't sure for the Canadian goods going in if they would get through or what would happen. The same thing at the Mexican side, and there was legal challenges, and you know, there was a lot of uncertainty and risk for Americans taking part. It was illegal what they were doing.
Well, there was all kinds of stuff that happened, you know, in the last 20 years in regards to the caravan. And usually when you leave a country, it's no problem to leave. It's where you're entering. Well, the problem with this caravan was that it was the problem for the country that we were leaving. And we had no problem with Canada. We had no problem with Mexico. The problem was the United States. And the whole idea of these caravans is that we were not doing it secretly. We would very clearly and loudly state that we are doing this because we want to break the blockade, because it is illegal, immoral, and needs to be gotten rid of. So there were hunger strikes, there were beatings from police to caravanistas, there was all kinds of stuff. But the fact of the matter is that those caravan got to Cuba each and every time because of the tremendous support that was received from all over the country.
So well, it's pretty hard to be discreet when you're in a big yellow school bus painted up with signs and symbols and flags of support for exactly. The Cuban government.
Exactly. The one of the most favorite things that I remember about the caravans was that at one point we sent a bunch of stuff, and sometimes they wanted us to pay a bond, and this was so that we wouldn't bring it to the States and then sell it or leave it into the States. But the bond was that when we left from the U.S. into Mexico, that bond would be paid back to us. So it was an assurance that, yes, we were entering the U.S. with these goods, but we would be taking them out at the other end. And at one point, we had a bunch of computers, and while we were trying to cross into Mexico, those computers were seized, amongst other stuff from the United States. And so we went back to the border in Blaine and complained that we had paid the bond. We were told that we were okay to cross the U.S. with, but then they were seized. And so I had a whole 2-3 page sort of note that I had that I was reading to one of the officers in charge in the Blaine Customs. And then at the end of my reading to him what we thought, we said, you know, we hope that one day the blockade will be gone, and that you people like yourself can go to Cuba and visit our neighbors. And believe it or not, this officer, while I was shaking his hands, he says, "I hope that too."
Well,
I wish I had that in video, because it was a great thing. I mean, you know, this is an officer of the customs in the U.S. that basically agreed that the blockade should be gone, and that, you know, it wouldn't be bad for him to go to Cuba and visit his neighbors. So that was quite neat.
Well, and it seemed for a while there that the President of the United States agreed too, and conditions seemed to be improving between the United States and Cuba during the Obama years. I mean, it wasn't the blockade wasn't fully pulled off or anything, but there was a loosening of the screws, and the economy in Cuba was picking up. Americans were allowed on a limited but less limited way to go into the country. Money was being sent into the country from Cubans living abroad, remittances, and then came Trump.
Yeah. Well, Obama, I mean, you know, he went to Cuba and all that and made it almost look as if, you know, as if really the blockade was over. It wasn't over at all, actually. Some of the biggest fines against banks that were dealing with Cuba, that was being given during the Obama years. But yes, it did sort of allow Cuba to breed some fresh air, but it was still pretty bad. But under Trump, of course, it got much, much, much worse. I mean, he either blocked, delayed, or increased the cost of the arrival of petroleum shipments, increased the blocking of commerce and transfers of funds to the country, stopped Cubans living in the U.S. from sending any money to their Cuban family members in Cuba. 400 Western Union offices in Cuba has been shut down. A number of flights going from the U.S. to Cuba.
Well, these Western Union offices, that's a really important that's an important closure. What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is that now, if I was a Cuban American, if I was a Cuban living in the U.S. working there, and I wanted to send some money back to my mother or my father or my uncle or my cousin, I wouldn't be able to do that. Because there's no way now that Cuban Americans can actually send money to Cuba. There's no financial organization that can do that. So it's a pretty sad reality. That's what it boils down to, you know.
Well,
so
now,
that's what this Western Union is all about, is that before you could go to the bank or to the Western Union and say, okay, I want to send my my father $200. They can't do that now.
Well, I was quite surprised during the recent American elections when Joe Biden went against the norm by campaigning, saying that he was going to loosen things up with Cuba. This is like writing your own death warrant in Florida, or at least it's a political death warrant. I mean, it's or maybe something more. At least it's always been thought that way. But I've read reports that the next generation, this is like the third generation of Cuban exiles in Florida, they don't really share their parents and grandparents' positions on the Cuban reality.
Well, first of all, there's been a lot of Cubans that have left Cuba in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years that have not left Cuba because of politics, but they've left it because of economic situation. So, but the first Cubans that came after the revolutions, there were a lot of, you know, basically it was mainly political. They disagreed with the government, and a lot of them had property, had a lot of money, had casinos, had hotels, whatever they had, and you know, they were nationalized. So a lot of all of those folks ended up in Miami. So they hated the revolution. They wanted their goods back, and so they basically were the ones to say, you know, let's blockade it, and let's do this, and let's sabotage it, and let's do all kinds of stuff. I mean, everything under the sun was used against the Cuban Revolution. Threats, terrorism, blockade, I mean, you name it, invasion almost in 1960 there. So but the new generation now, they are not in the United States because they hate their, I mean, there are some, yeah, that do hate the government, but the overwhelming majority of them is not that anymore. It's basically they want to have, you know, a few extra dollars, or they want to have more. And in a lot of cases, they send it back to their family. A lot of money that they make goes back to Cuba to support their families. And so Trump put an end to that. And I believe that didn't work in his favor altogether. Yes, some did, but no, I mean, you know, there's Cubans that want to support their families. You know, so they're not going to support a policy like that. And why not give them the freedom to figure out if they want to send money or not? You know?
Well, I haven't heard. I mean, Biden has backtracked or backpedaled on some of his campaign promises in different areas. I haven't really heard him say much about Cuba, though, that the American Senate has started to turn the screws, and some of the big media outlets in the United States, especially things like the Wall Street Journal, have started to warn him off loosening the screws on Cuba when he's got them sort of where he wants them, I suppose, is the thinking there. Have you heard anything about which direction Biden will take or any policy announcements?
He hasn't stated much. His lips have been pretty much shut on not only this issue, but many, many issues. But the fact of the matter is that he is re-employing a lot of the Obama crowd. So I would think that, I don't think anyone can be as bad as Trump. But, the Cubans know that the Democrats or the Republicans are going the same direction. Only that one does it one way and the other does it the other way. So, but I think, you know, the Democrats have always been a little bit more, I don't know what words to choose, but, not as extreme. Maybe that's, you get the Republicans, they're extreme. And people suffer from that, you know. So hopefully there will be less of that because, you know, Cubans are just like anyone else. They have the same needs and, they want to survive like anyone else. And you know, like Cuba has never been a threat to anyone. They've never invaded anyone. They've never threatened anyone. You know, it's the United States that just been trying to choke Cuba over and over and over again. And it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked. And that's why, you know, they're trying it in Venezuela. They've tried it in Bolivia. They're trying it in Nicaragua and it does not work. You know, they're going to have to come up with the understanding that the world has to go forward. It cannot go backward. The people, the developing countries, people will not accept what was going on a number of years ago where, as I stated before, you know, we go to these countries, we do what we want, we tell them what to do, and that's not going to happen anymore. You know, it's still happening, you know, and they want it to happen. But in the long run, it's not going to work. It's just not going to work, you know.
Well, if you've just tuned in again, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Randy Caravaggio. Randy's a social justice defender. He's worked with Victoria's Goods for Cuba campaign for a very long time and with Pastors for Peace Caravans, as we were just talking about. He's also been a constant champion for the revolutions in Venezuela and Bolivia and Cuba, of course, a strong, stout supporter of Palestinian sovereignty as well. Well, I saw something rather disturbing yesterday, Randy, and this is coming from the British newspaper, The Guardian. And I always prick up my ears when The Guardian starts breaking cover because they seem to be the point of the spear, so to speak. But what they were writing about here is something that they call the San Isidro movement in Cuba. And it's this group of artists saying that they feel that their freedom of expression is being impinged by the government. They're starting a very photogenic campaigns of civil disobedience. It sort of started to smell a little bit like the Pussy Riot demonstrations in Russia, if you remember that. They are quite confrontational and outrageous, the more so to provoke the authorities, it seems, into action and into arrests and so forth. Are you following these Isidro movers?
I'm very well aware of the San Isidro incident there. This is not the first, and it won't be the last, but it is very, very similar to what's been taking place over and over again. This is not about freedom of speech or freedom of artistic expression, as the few people involved in this would like for us to believe, but about a political opposition well funded by the U.S. imperial power to rid of the Cuban Revolution and to restore neocolonialism. That's what this is all about. There's the Cuban state, the Cuban government has put on TV for all the Cubans to see that these folks have been totally attached to the U.S. embassy in Cuba. They are driven one of the official from the U.S. embassy has driven some of these folks back and forth. There's money that's involved. And the proof is there. I mean, Danny Solis, who ended up in jail for, I think it's 8 months. And basically, he's been known to the police there. He's been harassing tourists. He's been harassing the police. I mean, the police, it's basically a petty criminal, this kind of guy. But anyways, then there's all the other guys that are involved in, and it just doesn't jive to call these folks representing any moral grounds whatsoever. This is a U.S. Sort of instigated situation that is being repeated over and over again. I mean, just 2 months ago, I believe it was around 2 months ago, Trump gave another $2 million for these types of groups to work in Cuba. So they are well funded and everything. Now, if you look at the artistic or cultural movement in Cuba, it's one of the strongest in the world. I've been there a number of times. Anyone that goes there can see the culture is very, very strong. The expression on these kinds of activities is strong. Now, if one analyzes how the government of Cuba is organized and works, one would see this very clearly, that these people going, to the Ministry of Culture, demanding that they want a meeting with the president, and that they had a list of all the people that should be there and should not be there, of all the media that should be here and should not be here. I mean, can you imagine this happening in Colombia? Can you imagine this happening in the West Bank? Asking the Israeli government to say, we are going to take over the Ministry of Culture if you don't have a meeting with us. I mean, it's insane, So I don't know what to say about it, except, this is just another media show that the U.S. does with Cuba. That's what it's about.
Well, and in this Guardian article, they quote Esteban Rodriguez, but then they maybe there was a pang of conscience over at the Guardian, I don't know, but then they admit that Esteban works for ADN Cuba, a Florida-based online news outlet that admits that it was awarded $410,000 from USAID. And that the U.S. spends, according to The Guardian, $20 million a year on anti-government media and, quote, democracy promotion programs for Cuba. And again, this article, for those that want to look it up themselves, is Havana Artists Find Their Voice in a Call to Defend Creative Freedom. Yeah, I can't imagine what you describe, Randy, even happening in Canada, if a bunch of artists got together and said, we demand to speak to Pierre Trudeau or to Justin Trudeau.
Yeah.
Sorry, Pierre. I can't imagine that getting them very far either.
Well, I mean, you got countries where basically people are being disappeared and killed and tortured and everything, and then they get to Cuba and they start this I don't know what you would call it, this crazy thing where, all of a sudden they do this media thing saying that they don't have the freedom of speech and all this kind of stuff, which is totally, totally ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. I mean, when I go to Cuba, I walk the streets and I hear all kinds of opinions. The Cubans are well, very, very expressive. And if they don't like something, they tell you, at least the ones I've talked, and I walk the streets. I don't just go to meetings with different officials. I walk the streets, and I usually have either another Cuban with me or a translator so I can speak to them openly. And, you can get involved. If you don't like something, you can get involved. You can go to the ministry. You can talk to them. And the ministry stated that they will meet with anyone in Cuba that is not being sponsored by the U.S. embassy or has ties with the U.S. Embassy. They've stated that with this thing when they brought them a list of all the people that had to be there and not be there and all the media and all this stuff. So I think Cuba has been very, very clear that any issues that Cubans are having, that they will look at it, and they have looked at it historically. They have, you know. But when they are attached to an enemy country that's blockading them and doing all kinds of stuff, well, they said we're just not going to have anything to do with that. And I think they have every right to do so. You know.
Well, yes.
But, you know, again, I mean, you know, in Palestine, there's people being butchered every day. You know, and what are we doing with the government of Israel?
Well,
what are we doing with the government of Saudi Arabia? What are we doing with the government of Egypt? What are we doing with all these different governments in Latin America butchering people over and over again? You know, and yet we pick on Cuba, which has a record spectacular in regard. I mean, you know, any UN reports on Cuba is pretty spectacular in comparison with other countries. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, it's insane. So what happens with countries like Venezuela, like Bolivia, like Nicaragua? You know, they smear them and they repeat the same lies on how bad they are. And so, of course, if some people hears this over and over and over again without really going, you know, and looking at these United Nations reports and stuff, they'll start to buy it.
Yeah. Well, and we can judge somebody by their friends, and Canada is on very close terms with these governments you mentioned, Colombia being one of the more outrageous of them. Well, Esteban Rodriguez, he also was very supportive of the end of remittances from the United States to Cuba. He thought that was a great idea. And President Miguel Diaz-Canel, he said that he called this a media show, what the San Ysidro guys were up to. And he says it was, quote, a strategy of non-conventional warfare aimed at overthrowing the revolution. So, you know, this, and he was addressing it openly to a crowd. It's not like this is a secret or anything.
Yeah. No, Dennis Solis confessed to receiving money from a person associated with the attacks carried out in Cuba. I mean, he confessed. It's not like, you know, and the, you know, the good thing about the Cuban government is that they take the facts and they show it to their citizens. Now, of course, this usually doesn't go outside to the mainstream media. So what the mainstream media does is report whatever somebody comes out with and reports it instead of going on the ground and figuring out what's going on. And they can do that. It's not like they're denied. They can go to Cuba. They can go to places and ask people, you know, what's going on. So but you know, there's one of the media persons that was supposed to go at that meeting or was demanded by these people was that from the United States they went to Mexico and then from Mexico they went to Cuba. And so the Cuban government stated or asked, now why would they have to go to Mexico to come to Cuba? You know, they could come straight from the US to Cuba if they wanted to, right? So, but you know, these are media plays. You know, you wanna make somebody look bad, so you produce a situation where, and of course you got your own media that's going to report on it. So you produce these things, you know, and you go with it, and you make another lie sound truthful, but it isn't, you know. And the crazy thing about it is that there is no way that these incidents is going to create or change things in Cuba. I mean, Cuba is very, very well organized. You know, the women movement has the biggest organization in the world. Everyone, all the workers in Cuba are unionized. You know, they're CDRs. The government, if one looks at how the government gets elected and so on and so forth, you'll see that it is very hard for an imperialist country to go over there you know, and do whatever they think they're going to do. I mean, the president of Cuba, Miguel Diaz-Canel, stated with this incident that they're in the wrong country if they want to produce what they think they're going to produce. They're just in the wrong country.
Well, and the new president, unlike Fidel Castro and then later his brother Raul, they don't attract the current president isn't so flamboyant or charismatic that the Americans can point at him as the evil dictator, the next Hitler, and everything as they're wont to do. The power is distributed in Cuba. Well, Randy, we're fast running out of time, but I invoked earlier the ghost of Pierre Trudeau. There was a time when Canada was a good friend, at least on the surface of Cuba. What's your take on Canada's current government's position and the way it's reflected in the state press here?
Well, I remember even Chrétien going to Cuba, you know, before he was out of power. I think that the Canadian governments, conservative or liberal, I think they understand that there's overwhelming Canadian support for Cuba, you know, and I think that that's hard to change for any governments. I mean, we've had good relations with Cuba all along. The United States has tried quite a lot to make, our policies go against Cuba, but it hasn't worked because, you know, I mean, most of the tourists that goes to Cuba, the majority are Canadians. And we have businesses there too. You know, you got the Sherritt Company, which is a very, very big company. Mining nickel, and they're involved in tourism, they're involved in energy, communication, transportation. So it's I think that the Canadian government, no matter how much they may think about wanting to go along with the United States, I think the Canadian society tells them you better don't do that because that's not a good idea. I think that's, you know, that's the way it goes. I mean, you know, Canada and Mexico were the only two countries that never broke relation with Cuba since the revolution. So that's good news. And myself and all of us that support democracy should applaud that and should let the Canadian government know that they should follow in those steps, and not just with Cuba, but also with Venezuela and with Nicaragua and with any other countries that are trying to do their thing. They have every right to elect who they want, to have the system that they want. And as long as they don't threaten anyone else, they have every right to do that, as much as we have that right.
Well, you know? Randy Caravaggio, can you, on leaving, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work and others that are working towards the goals you outline?
Well, locally, I mean, we have, by the way, it used to be the goods for Cuba, but since we have not worked with the caravans as much, now it is the Friends of Cuba. And we, of course, now with COVID, everything is on hold, but our normal events, you know, on the third Thursday of every month, we have a social justice film night where people can come and we discuss different issues about different countries. We send steel goods for Cuba, but our committee once a year goes there and delivers the goods and meets with various organizations and stuff. People can go to our website and support us with funds. We have events throughout the year. We celebrate the July 26th event, which was the date when the Cuban Revolution started. We have the victory celebrations January the 1st. Of course, it's not going to happen this year because of COVID. So we have a lot of different things. But we have a website, Friends of Cuba, and people can around our local area can support us hopefully as much as they can.
So that's what, friendsofcuba.org? Or all right. Well, thanks a lot, Randy, for coming on and telling us about it today, eh? And for all the work you've done over these long years and the commitment you've had to social justice.
What I can say is it has been a real great pleasure to work for such a small country that's done so much, not just for Cuba, but for the world in regards to teachers and doctors and all kinds of other things. And I think we should cherish such countries. And it's been a real pleasure for me and our committee and the people that support us to be in friendship and in solidarity with such a country.
Hasta la victoria.
Exactly. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, my great pleasure.
Que se ha ido, por el que se va. Agua del tiempo que corre, muere.